Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Dara McDonald, and we have a sponsor this week, which is StatHead. We've all had that moment when we look at a player's stats and it raises more questions. When did someone last hit for a cycle? How many pitchers had an ERA that low over any 20-game span? StatHead has the answers. StatHead is your all-access pass to go inside the Baseball Reference database and answer virtually any questions about baseball stats and history. Use code MLBTR for 20% off annual baseball or annual all sports subscriptions. We're going to talk about what's going on in the baseball world, and here to talk to me about it is my colleague Anthony Franco. How's it going, Anthony?
I'm doing well, Dara. How are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. I'm excited. Baseball is so close. I mean, obviously, spring training is happening, but regular season baseball is only a week away. We are recording this on the morning of Tuesday, March 12th. And because of the Seoul series in Korea, the Dodgers and Padres are going to be starting the regular season next week. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. Are you setting your alarm for 6 a.m.?
I don't think I'll be setting my alarm, but what about you? You going to get up and watch it?
Probably not. That feels like a wake up, check the box score, maybe watch the highlight package on MLB TV.
Yeah, I think I'll probably be in the same boat. But it's exciting. Real baseball, so close. We have almost made it through the winter. So the big storylines right now are mostly about injuries, as is often the case in spring training. So we have to be a little bit careful here, Anthony and I, because we are recording this, like I said, on the morning of Tuesday, March 12th. So we don't have full information. As of this recording, we know that Lucas Giolito is going to have some kind of elbow surgery. It seems like it's going to be either full Tommy John surgery or some kind of internal brace situation. But either way, he's out for the 2024 season. So that's bad news for him and the Red Sox. And also, Gerrit Cole is having an MRI on his elbow. We don't know the severity of anything, but apparently he's had trouble bouncing back after throwing recently and is going to get multiple opinions before the Yankees decide to proceed. So a little scary situation, but we don't know how it's going to play out yet as of this recording. So this has led to a lot of speculation because a lot of free agents are still out there. Blake Snell, Jordan Montgomery, Michael Lorenzen, and others. It feels a little bit ghoulish to talk about it right after all these injuries, but do you think this has a notable effect on the market, Anthony?
Yeah, I mean, it could. Like you said, you kind of caveated it on Cole. We don't really know what's going on, but I do think that if that turns out to be a long-term absence, that should really push the Yankees to jump further in on Snell. I understand that the luxury tax payments would be outrageous for that, but I don't think that they could go into the season with that rotation if they expect Cole to miss a good chunk of the year. On Giolito, you know, I know that you and Tim talked about this last week, just as to whether or not Giolito's injury should push the Red Sox to be more aggressive on Montgomery, or whether it should sort of push them to take the opposite view, which is, okay, we were already kind of long shots in 2024. Now we just lost the guy who we expected to be maybe our best pitcher, depending on how they feel about Brian Bello. And so we could kind of just call it, not throw in the white or wave the white flag, but kind of call it as like, okay, this is probably not going to happen in 24. We're not going to splurge on a starting pitcher this offseason, and we'll reevaluate next winter. So where do you come out on them? And then what do you think about the Yankees?
I suspect that the Red Sox probably are in the latter camp that you just outlined. I think they have a budget for this year that they didn't want to go past, and they're probably pretty close to it because all indications are, you know, they keep checking in on Montgomery and not getting close to a deal. So I think their appetite for more spending is pretty low. And so I think, like you said, maybe waving, like throwing in the towel is maybe too aggressive, but they'll just acknowledge that they probably aren't going to do it this year. And so they'll probably just sit tight. The Yankees are in a very, very interesting spot. Again, if Cole is going to miss significant time, because they're so pot committed to this year, because they got Soto as their big offseason splash. 1 year of Juan Soto. He's a free agent after this year. They're paying him, I forget the exact number, it's over 30 million, 32, 33, whatever it is. Plus, because of their luxury tax status, roughly $30 million in taxes because of having Soto on the team. And they gave up five players to get him. So they are so, they have so many chips on the table for 2024 being like, you know, we got Juan Soto, let's make a big push this year. And then if suddenly, if Cole is not there, then the rotation really starts to look flimsy. But like you said, any extra spending now comes with 110% tax rate. So if you give Snell, even if you can bargain him down to like $20 million a year kind of thing, that still means you're paying over $40 million this year just to add Snell to replace Cole. So it's a tricky spot for them. What do you think? You think they'll do it? I think they kind of have to, but...
Yeah, I mostly think they will. I mean, part of it, too, is that they gave up so much of their rotation depth to get Soto in the first place, which I thought was a good trade for them. But obviously, that puts them in a position where if they lost Cole, then it's really thin at the back end. And it's, yeah, like you said, it's, I feel like it's sort of similar to where the Giants are at as well, where it's just like, okay, you guys have now made all these commitments for this year. You know, I'm sure that they'll try to keep Soto around beyond this year, but you can't assume that you're going to sign him to a long-term deal. He's almost certainly going to at least test free agency. And it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me for ownership of the front office. It, again, if Cole's injury turns out to be serious, we don't know, to sit there and say, well, okay, we're content. We're kind of at our spending limit and we're just going to go in as sort of longer shots to catch the Orioles and hope for a wild card. Like, that doesn't seem like great operating procedure to me.
Yeah. So we'll see how those situations play out. As mentioned, we don't have all the facts yet. So if you're listening to this, you probably know more than we do because you have checked MLBTradeRumors.com and got the latest news. So let's go to other news. Another, we've touched on the Red Sox a bit. They signed Brian Bayo to a notable extension. It is for 6 years, $55 million guarantee, plus a club option for 2030. Anthony, were you surprised by where this landed?
Not really. I mean, it was maybe a little higher than I would have guessed. It was pretty close to Hunter Green money. I would have expected Bayo to come in maybe a little below that, just given how highly regarded Green was as a prospect. But I think it's about right. Nothing shocking. What do you think of Bayo? I guess both the money, because you wrote the post on that, and just him as a pitcher. Do you think there's sort of another gear for him, and he's like a borderline top of the rotation guy moving forward? Or do you think he's more of like a 3-4 type?
I think it's possible that it's in there. I mean, his strikeout rate in the majors thus far has been kind of underwhelming, but he has had stronger strikeout numbers in the minors. So if he even takes like a small step forward there, then, you know, he moves from, you know, the mid rotation guy that he kind of looks like now to more of a front of the rotation guy. I mean, he strikes me as sort of a Stroman type, lots of ground balls. And so, you know, if you got Stroman on this deal when Stroman was 24 years old, the way that, you know, Stroman's age 24 through 30 seasons or whatever, I mean, you'd probably be pretty happy about having him at this price point. I was still a little surprised because, yeah, like you mentioned, I was looking at Hunter Green as a pretty close comp in terms of like experience, but Green just had more prospect hype. And obviously he has, you know, like triple digit heat. And so it's easy to imagine him, you know, reaching a higher ceiling in the years to come than maybe it is with Bayo. So I thought that Bayo would end up a little bit under Green, but yeah, good for him to get just a little bit over. So the Red Sox, this rotation, I mean, Bayo's nice, but as we mentioned with Giolito, this rotation is still kind of looking flimsy now, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's not good. It's, they have a lot of guys with talent, but most of them are either unproven or it's like they've been inconsistent in their careers or they've been better as relievers. You know, I think a lot of it is just like they've tried Tanner Houck and Garrett Whitlock in the rotation before. And even Nick Pivetta, who I think is a clear starting pitcher at this point, but he's been better in his limited relief time than he has as a starter over the course of his career. I know he finished well as a starter last year, but kind of an up and down career for him as well. And again, I think we both like Bayo, but he sort of tailed off at the end of last season, and that was his first full big league season. It's just like they have a lot of guys where you can see a way that they're productive starters, but I don't know that there's any of them that you feel super confident in being at least an above average starting pitcher, maybe aside from Bayo.
Well, they have many years with Bayo locked in now, so perhaps the club is just focused on the long term. Like we mentioned with the Giolito stuff, maybe they're not really worried too much about 2024, and they'll think about how things play out in the years to come. But he should be there, a nice anchor for them. So I think it's nice for Red Sox fans to have him there as that anchor. Another big piece of news this week: Mookie Betts, everyday shortstop. This is pretty nuts, right, Anthony?
Certainly unexpected. I guess, how concerned are you by it? Do you think that it's an issue both, you know, for Betts kind of moving forward, and that the Gavin Lux thing, you know, the throwing issues, do you think that that's still something that they should be concerned about, even with him at second base? And is Miguel Rojas going to be the starting shortstop for the Dodgers by the end of April?
Well, I'm not concerned. I'm fascinated by it, because this is really unprecedented. I think it was Sarah Langs was tweeting about this, and she said that, I might butcher this, but she said, of guys who have multiple Gold Glove awards in the outfield, Mookie Betts is already the leader in innings played at shortstop, because he played like 16 innings or 16 games, like some small amount there last year. And that was already unprecedented, just for him to get a small amount of time at shortstop after being a Gold Glove outfielder. This just doesn't happen. He's like 31 years old and has spent most of his career in right field. And I know people say that, you know, he came up as a second baseman as a prospect, and the Red Sox moved him to the outfield because they had Dustin Pedroia at second base at the time. But it's still wild. And the reason I find this situation so fascinating, because part of the reason why I love baseball so much is that, unlike, you know, basketball or football, where a LeBron James or a Tom Brady, you just put them on the roster and it just completely changes the whole thing. Like, one player can just completely change the outlook of a franchise. Baseball, you can't really do that. Like, the nine guys in the lineup have to take turns, and the pitchers take turns, and you can't just have superstar players dominate. You need to have a full, well-rounded roster, and no team has a perfect roster. Like, this offseason, when the Dodgers were getting Ohtani and Yamamoto and Glasnow and Teoscar Hernandez, a lot of fans were getting frustrated. Oh, the Dodgers are just buying the World Series. I don't need to watch this season. But nothing, they haven't bought anything. You can't guarantee anything. The Dodgers have a lot of great players, but they have this giant question mark in the middle infield now. Like, no team has a perfect roster, no matter how much they spend. And so I find it fascinating that this team that dominated the headlines all winter by getting all these superstars now has a 31-year-old right fielder that they're trying to plug in as their everyday shortstop, and fingers crossed, hope for the best. It's fascinating to me. As to whether it works out or not, I have no idea. Do you?
I'm not super optimistic about it, but I will say, you know, I mean, to your point, yes, this is the left side infield defense, and I guess maybe the back of the rotation, you could say, given the injuries that they have, but those are probably the weak points on what is objectively an excellent roster. And I do think that they have the sort of leeway, given how good the rest of the team is, to experiment with it early on. And they have Rojas to fall back. So, like, if it becomes clear that over 3 or 4 weeks that, like, Betts just doesn't have the range or the arm strength or whatever it is to play shortstop, and he has to move back to second base, where I think he would be fine. They could plug Rojas in there and just sort of accept that, like, yeah, okay, this is not ideal having him as a starter on a playoff team, but the rest of our lineup is so good that we can live with just an all glove shortstop.
I also think that you could see a lot of mid game changes, because, you know, the lineup is great, so you can plug Betts in there at shortstop to start the game. Lux is a very good hitter, so having him at second is good. If he's, like, you know, your number 8 or 9 hitter, that's great. And, you know, if it gets to, like, the 6th inning and the Dodgers are winning, whoever they're playing that day, if they're up 8-3, then, you know, Rojas comes in at short and you move Betts over to second, so you have better defense for the final innings when you already have a 5-run lead. So it might be a situation where, you know, we talk a lot about, like, 5-and-dive pitchers in the modern game, where, like, Mookie Betts just needs to be a 5-and-dive shortstop.
Yeah. I will say I am sort of concerned about it from a longer term perspective for Lux specifically, just because this isn't the first time that he's had the throwing accuracy issues. That was an issue as a prospect too, and at least part of the reason why he moved off of shortstop in the minors. And it's something like, he is a good hitter, as you mentioned, but he's a good hitter for a second baseman. If it got to a point where he's like a non-viable middle infielder because the throwing is such an issue, I don't know where that leaves him, because I don't think the bat is good enough to play in like the corner outfielder at first base. So we're certainly not at that point yet. They're going to give him a shot at second base, and he's played there before and been fine. But anytime that you have guys who have struggled with this kind of thing before and then it pops back up, it's always, that's always a concern to me.
Right. Well, like I mentioned, I'm fascinated by it. And, you know, like I said, it proves that even the best teams have question marks and things to figure out. So it'll be a fascinating thing to watch. And if Betts does do great at shortstop, it'll just add to what's already been an amazing career. So let's move across the West. We got another story in the division this week. The Giants released JD Davis. It's not necessarily a surprise that he's not, that they're moving on from him, because they signed Matt Chapman and it sort of looked like he was squeezed. But the way it played out, I think it surprised a few people, didn't it?
Sure. I mean, it sort of surprised me a little bit, you know, in the sense that I did think at the time that they signed Chapman, we talked about it, I did think that they were going to be able to find a taker for Davis. I didn't think he had much surplus trade value, but I would have expected that somebody would have been willing to take on a salary and plug him in as an everyday third baseman. And clearly that didn't happen. The Giants tried to trade him. That wasn't available. They put him on waivers. Anyone could have had him for just the $6.9 million arbitration salary, and the entire league passed. And so he got released. He's going to get termination pay. That's like a fraction of what he would have made on a salary, barring some kind of grievance, which doesn't strike me as particularly likely. And then he's going to sign for less than the difference. So it does stink from his perspective. He's going to lose money on this for something that really was kind of beyond his control. But I also sort of understand it for the Giants. Like, it just, they signed a better third baseman and they signed a better DH, and they already have Wilmer Flores, who does the same kind of thing that Davis does off the bench. And it just felt like he was kind of redundant on that roster at this point. No.
Yeah. I mean, from the roster fit in San Francisco, it all makes sense. I think even though Davis wasn't a free agent, he was a victim of the weak free agent market, the same as Chapman or Bellinger or any of these people signing late. Because, you know, we've seen infielders sign in the past couple of weeks. You know, Gio Urshela is another solid everyday third baseman. I mean, you could debate whether Davis or Urshela, who's better, but they're both like sort of in the same tier of not elite, but solid third baseman type guys. Urshela just signed with the Tigers for only $1.5 million. So Davis at 6.9, it's understandable that not a lot of teams would want to pay that, because like the market has clearly shown that that caliber of third baseman is not getting paid right now. So yeah, so they didn't find a taker. I mean, this release situation, we should probably talk about a little bit, because it's unique. This kind of thing doesn't happen every day. The two sides went to an arbitration hearing, and Davis won. He earned, in the eyes of the arbiters, that $6.9 million salary. Now the Giants are cutting him loose, and they're only going to have to pay him $1.1 million out of that 6.9. And there's a rule that says they can do this for players who have failed to exhibit sufficient skill or competitive ability. Now, Davis is mashing this spring so far. I'm reading our colleague Steve Adams wrote this up for the website the other day. Davis is 6-for-15 so far in spring with a pair of homers. So his slash line is 400, 471, 800. So this language, does it mean anything? Is it enforceable? Can Davis and his representatives do anything? Can the MLBPA do anything? What's the situation there?
I mean, I think the short answer is we don't know, just because, like you mentioned, there's not a ton of precedent for this. It does happen every once in a while that players get released early in spring training so that teams can do the termination pay thing and save some money. But they're typically not as high profile as Davis. I'm skeptical that that language will have any sort of effect. Maybe it inspires them to file a grievance. I would be very surprised if they won. But I know that's like Tim Durkas, the MLBTR founder, seems to be more receptive to that as a possibility. To me, I think that's kind of boilerplate language that's more so designed to protect guys who get injured early in spring. And it's like, okay, you know, you had a $3 million arb salary as a pitcher and you came in and blew out your elbow on your first game of spring training and the team released you. Like, I think that's more what that provision is trying to protect, as opposed to players like Davis, who, you know, is a good player and a viable major leaguer, but ultimately just got squeezed off the roster by a better player. But I do think it's unfortunate for him. And I think that the system itself, like, you know, the CBA kind of makes a distinction now between players who settle before they go to an arbitration hearing and then players who go through the hearing. Like, if Davis had settled for $6.5 million, that would have been fully guaranteed. But because he went to the hearing, and then it's not, like, I think that's just kind of a stupid distinction to begin with. But to me, like, this is just sort of what the CBA builds in as an out for teams, and the Giants took it.
So every once in a while, we hear these things of the players filing a grievance, and then it seems like roughly 100% of the time, it leads nowhere. Do you know anything about the grievance process? Who do you grieve to? Like, who hears the grievance? Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm not sure. I think it has to be some sort of independent arbitrator, I would assume. But yeah, like you said, it just feels like every time that, you know, the service time manipulation ones that ever came up, like, they always lost.
Right. And the union would also complain about, you know, small market teams, not like revenue sharing recipients, not spending enough of the revenue sharing money that they get. There was a grievance about that that went nowhere.
I'm not sure that ever actually got heard, or if they just dropped it as part of the CBA. Yeah. But right, that was like, it was in the hopper for like 10 years complaining about revenue sharing and just never got anywhere.
So you're assuming that Davis is probably just like out of luck and
I just think it's very deal. Easy for teams to sort of justify most of these decisions, even if they're clearly at least largely financially motivated, that there's some sort of baseball logic to them, and the arbiters just always sort of defer to the teams on those.
All right. Well, that means for teams looking for third base help, Davis is out there, and I guess he can be had for very cheap. So what else we got going on in the news today? We also got surprising news that came out of nowhere. Noel V. Marte of the Reds got an 80-game suspension due to a positive test for boldenone. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but some sort of performance-enhancing drug. So he's going to miss 80 games. He's going to miss the first almost half of the season. It's a good thing the Reds have about 17 infielders, right?
Yeah, nice cover there by you pretending that you're not a frequent user of Baltimore.
I've never heard of this thing.
I never heard of it either. Yeah, I mean, it stinks for them. Marte's a very talented young player. But like you said, I guess if it were going to happen to anyone, the Reds would be one of the teams best equipped to withstand losing an infielder. And, you know, I don't think they knew that this was going to happen when they signed Jamer Candelario, but it makes the Candelario signing look a lot more important now, because he can just step in at third base and probably play there pretty much every day for at least the first half until Marte's back.
Yeah. So Marte, it seemed, was slated to be the everyday third baseman. Candelario was going to play there sometimes and also play some first, but now, even without Marte, they should still have a good infield. Again, I mean, there's risk. Some of these young guys, you never know who's going to have a sophomore slump or whatever. But you can have Candelario at third, Ellie De La Cruz at short, Matt McClain at second, Christian Encarnacion Strand at first. Then you have Jonathan India bouncing around. You have Spencer Steer bouncing around. Both of those guys playing some infield and some outfield. Even Tyler Stevenson plays some first base when he's not catching a little bit. So they still have lots of guys, but obviously they would rather have Marte in there. Every time I think about the NL Central, I can't think of who I think is the favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of leaning towards the Reds, but I don't think that there's a clear favorite. Like, to me, I think you can make an argument for anyone aside from Pittsburgh as the best team in the NL Central. This wouldn't really change it for him. Like, I mean, again, this is a small hit to the Reds, but I think having Candelario there is a capable fill-in, and it just like deals a little bit of a hit to the infield depth, but this wouldn't, to me, dramatically change the division outlook.
All right, well, let's get to your questions. We got a bunch of questions here. Jeff wants to know, who had the worst offseason and why is it the Angels? Yeah, I would say the Angels definitely have not had a great offseason. But do you think it's the worst?
Man, it might be. It's close. We were talking about this before the show. You said no. I think it might be, with the caveat that Blake Snell is still out there. And I do think that the Angels, whether it's Snell or JD Martinez, or I guess even potentially Montgomery, but it feels like Snell is likelier at this point. I do think that the Angels are one of the likeliest teams to still make an addition of significance at this point. So I don't want to completely bury their offseason yet, because I guess it's not over. But yeah, I mean, just generally what they've done so far, I don't understand it. Like, they let Ohtani walk, which is, I mean, okay, that was always seemed likely. But then they haven't done a whole lot to address the offense since then. It was like they brought in Aaron Hicks, and that's about it. And the rotation, they haven't done much. And they basically just signed like 9 relievers. And I just don't understand what the goal is. Like, to me, that doesn't pull them significantly closer to contention. They're a worse team, I think, than they were last year when they won 73 games. And I just don't understand, like, what is the end game here? But are you more optimistic on the direction of the franchise?
No, I mean, it's definitely not a great offseason. If I was trying to be charitable, I guess I would say that they're doing a sort of wait and see year, because they have a lot of young, exciting players. Like, in the post-Otani landscape, there would have been some people calling for a total rebuild. But they have, you know, they have Zach Neto, they have Nolan Chanuel, they have Logan Ohapi, they have Reed Detmers. They have all these like young pieces that you would like, it would be harder to justify a full rebuild when you have these young controllable guys already on the roster. So maybe they're just sort of, we're going to let these guys play it out for a year and then we'll see how we'll spend our money next winter. But that's obviously very unexciting for Angels fans. So it's definitely not a great offseason. I wouldn't put them as the worst, though, because there have been some teams that just really objectively, I mean, like the Padres, I would put up there as like, you know, like for cost saving purposes, intentionally made their team worse. The Rays, same thing, traded away a lot of good players. Some teams did nothing and still sort of, you know, like the Guardians did nothing. So I don't think the Angels would be the worst, but I understand why it's really underwhelming given the circumstances.
Would that change for you if they signed Snell? Do you think that would be a smart move?
Yeah, if they get him on like, you know, that Cody Bellinger type deal where it's 3 years with opt-outs or whatever, that's great, you know, because then if he has another great season, he'll just leave. And if not, it's only a couple years and, you know, having Blake Snell on your team for 3 years is pretty great, even if he's kind of, you know, if he ends up having another one of his underwhelming seasons in 2024. They don't have anybody as good as Snell, anybody close to it, I don't think. So,
yeah, I certainly agree with that.
All right. Well, here's a question from Charlie. Fact or fiction, the Red Sox are going to trade Masataka Yoshida.
Fiction. I don't think they can. He had a bad second half. I'm still kind of optimistic about him as a hitter, but he's a limited defensive player and they're 1 year removed from outbidding the entire league on him. At a time when I think a lot of people were kind of skeptical. I think they guaranteed what, 90 million, and the investment with the posting fee, I think, went over 100. And then his rookie season, he was a slightly above average hitter who was a very bad defensive left fielder and is already at DH. Like, he hasn't raised his value in any way. It's gone down to me. So even though I'm optimistic still about the play discipline and the pure bat to ball skills, like, I just don't think he's tradable right now.
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of his value. I imagine the Red Sox would be open to it because they've had a regime change since that deal was signed. When Yoshida was signed a year ago, it was still the Chaim Bloom era, and now it's the Craig Breslow era. And they also have a whole bunch of other guys on the roster who could probably use that DH spot. You know, Rafael Devers isn't an amazing defender at third. Tristan Casas might not be great at first. I don't want to completely write him off because he's still early in his career, but he's more of a bat first guy. And so it's not ideal roster construction to have all of these bat first kind of players. So I think the Sox would love to do it. And, you know, we saw with the Sale deal, like they ate most of his remaining contract to get Vaughn Grissom from Atlanta. But it's just a different thing. Like Yoshida, I think he still has 5 years left on his deal. Was this a 6 year deal?
I think it was five. There's four left.
Oh, so there's four left. But it's just harder to like eat all of that. But I imagine they would be willing. It's just if anybody would want him. So I think it's the kind of thing where like maybe if he takes a big step forward this year at the plate and is much more exciting than before, then maybe they try to sell high. But you're right that his value around the league isn't going to be amazing because everybody thought they overpaid at the time the deal was signed. And then when he had kind of an okay but not amazing season, that didn't do him any favors. All right, so we get time for one more question here. This one is from Richard, who says, considering the amount of effort the Tiger front office has put into fielding a major league team in the past 10 years, should Tiger fans feel slighted? They can wait, seems to be the attitude. Should Tiger fans just stop buying Little Caesars pizza and encourage their friends to buy their pizzas elsewhere? I am sure franchise owners enjoy being associated with a cheap loser. Wow, Richard, mincing words. Well, first of all, good luck getting people to stop buying those hot and readies at Little Caesars. But what do you think about the Tigers, Anthony?
Yeah, Richard came out firing. I understand the frustration about the overall organization, just in the sense that like the Tigers haven't been good in a decade. So I get why Richard's kind of fed up with everything. And for sure, like since Mike Ilitch passed and Chris Ilitch took over as ownership, they haven't spent the same way they used to. And so I get why, as a fan, that's just generally very irritating. I do think that the Tigers are trending up. I'm more optimistic about the Tigers now than I've been basically since the end of like their last competitive window. And I liked a lot of what they did this offseason. I thought they had a lot of good value buys, and the long-term books are kind of are pretty open, aside from the Javi Baez deal. And I do think that like the young talent's getting here. They invested in Colt Keith. They're a legitimate threat in the AL Central this year for me. And by 2025 and beyond, I think they should be set up pretty well for consistent contention. So enjoy the breadsticks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Get that crazy bread. It's going to be fine. Yeah, I agree. The Tigers are, I mean, it seemed like they were in a rut for a while because they had a lot of big contracts on the books, particularly Miguel Cabrera was still getting like $35 million a year as his career was tailing off. And so they did a rebuild, and then they thought the rebuild was over a couple of years ago. So they spent money on Eduardo Rodriguez and Javi Baez, and then those deals didn't work out and Al Avila got fired. And then the new regime has been trying to get the ducks in a row for the past year, 2 years. But things are trending in a good direction. So I think, Richard, sit tight and you'll be in good hands soon. But that's all the time we have for this show. Thanks for hanging out with me, Anthony.
Yeah, of course, Dara. Thanks for having me on.
So we'll be back with a new episode next week when it will be the regular season. Can you believe it? Almost there. But for now, keep going to MLBTradeRumors.com because the hot stove is still simmering. There's still free agents out there. News is happening. Check it out. Sign up for that front office package, and we'll get those ads off of there. And like I said, we'll have a new episode for you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLB Trade Rumors.